Boker Tov, everybody. Let's we learned the Siddur, how to daven to God, so you should help answer our tefillah. I believe this is class 154. I don't know where we're up to exactly, but okay, we'll finish off Vila Malshinim. We spoke about last week Shmuel Hakatan, why he's the one who has to compose it, and Hayden. We spoke, of course, last week on Asar B'Tevet also, but we'll get into some of the, quickly, some of the wording of the tefillah, which we didn't do yet, and at least most of it. So I just want to begin with quoting the Rambam, sort of it's a quasi-review of what we've spoken about. Just let me share my screen. This is the Rambam in Hilchot Tfilah, right, and Sefer Ahava. It's interesting, you know, the book, the Rambam divided all of Jewish law into 14 books. The Shulchan Aruch divides Jewish law into 4 books. The Rambam is a much broader category. Of course, the Rambam, that doesn't take up 10 books, but the Rambam is the only one who wrote Jewish law about things that didn't apply, about Korbanot, the Beit HaMikdash, things that had no practical applicability. But the Rambam had a much grander vision of what he was doing in Sefer and the Mishnah Torah, which is, you know, not for now exactly. Dr. Chorsky, you know, Isidore Chorsky has written a lot about that, other people. But the Rambam's first book is Mada, which today is translated as science, the book of knowledge, and, you know, Torah Mada. But that's where he talks about the Yesodei Torah, the fundamentals of Judaism. The laws of idolatry are there. The laws of tshuva are there. The laws of learning Torah are there. The Hilchot Deyot, that's, where the Rambam says you get 8 hours of sleep a day and how to eat healthily. You know, you should follow the middle path. Hilchot Deyot, whatever. I don't even know how they translate that in English. Deyot, I don't know. Character traits, I don't know exactly, but that's all in Sefer Mada. The second book is Sefer Ahava, the book of love. So that's the laws of Kriyat Shema, that expresses our love of God, and of course Hilchot Tefillah, which the Rambam puts together. You see on the top of my page here, Mishnah Torah, prayer and priestly blessing. The Rambam, there are two mitzvot, the third of in the Rambam's count of the 613. When we pray, one is to daven, and two is the kohanim have to bless us every day. Okay, that's just a broad overview. So the Rambam in the second chapter is going over the Shmona Esrei. He says, Bimei Rabban Gamliel, this we saw a little bit, Rabu Apikoros in Yisrael, there were a lot of heretics, however you translate Apikoros, in the Jewish people, by you mitzarim Yisrael, and they were causing tsar, pain, to the Jewish people, and a mesid is one who tries to convince you to do idolatry, to, you know, that the Torah discusses in Parshat Re, I believe, that the mesid and the mediach, two people who try to convince you to do idolatry, they, in theory, get a death penalty. As a matter of fact, where the laws that normally apply, we know it's basically impossible to give a death penalty, even if you want to, not that we want to anymore, but if you wanted to, it's next to impossible. Two witnesses, and they have to immediately before the act, they have to warn him, and the prince says, yes, I know, and I don't care, and then carry it back immediately. It's next to impossible. But when you deal with a mesid and a mediach, somebody who's trying to convince you to convert or to come leave Judaism, so we're allowed to do all kinds of tricks, and we lower the rules of evidence needed to give a death penalty. I don't know what happened actually when there was a Sanhedrin, but at least in theory, the rules, the way to give a death penalty is much, much easier. Anyway, a very amazing statement. And since they saw that this is greater than any other need, in other words, the way the Rambam is presenting, it sounds like the future of Judaism was under attack. And that actually is not so surprising. Where one generation after the destruction of the temple or so, one or two generations after, like think about this, like after the Holocaust, we mentioned many times, Rav Soloveitchik said, why did our generation get the state of Israel? Because we needed it. The Vilna Gaon, the Chafetz Chaim could live without the state of Israel. After the Holocaust, the Jewish people could not have survived. Basically, that's what the Rav seems to be saying. We would not have survived without the state of Israel after we went through. So imagine what they went through at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. And now it's even worse. Now you have half the Jews are leaving. They're becoming Hebrew Christians and et cetera. So This is the greatest threat. He doesn't even say for all the Jewish people, that like for all people. We need Judaism for the whole world. And Judaism was under serious threat. That's like it's what the Rambam seems to be saying, very powerful. Amar hu ubeit dino. So Rabban Gamliel and his court got up, and of course he doesn't mention here Shmuel, we discussed that, and they made this, we have to make a bracha. One bracha, Chidei Bashela Milifnei Hashem, one blessing, or it's interesting, you know, we think of a blessing as a nice thing. A bracha just means, you know, Baruch Atah Hashem. Obviously here it has a negative theme, but La'abed Apikorsim, to destroy the Apikorsim. Mekavautam B'Tfilah, very interesting also. And they established it in Tfilah. In other words, they could have done this another time. They could have done Friday night after Kiddush. Like, that's what the Rambam says. In other words, where do they make this? It's not really part of the Shmon Esrei. That's we didn't go through that. The Gemara wants to wonder what right do they have to add a 19th bracha, right? You can't just add what you want to a fixed. We had the Shmon Esrei. That was a fixed, sealed book. Like, we can't add a book in Tanakh. That's one of the reasons that Hanukkah is not in Tanakh. Is that the Tanakh is closed. Once the Tanakh is closed, you can't add a 25th book, right? So the Tefillah is closed. What do you mean you're going to add a Tefillah? So the Gemara needs some kind of justification how to do it in Shmon Esrei, but it was so important, you know, when things are really, really important, you find when there's a will, there's a way, or whatever, you know, when there's a need, that's what you got to do. But Kavoto B'Tefillah, and he established it in the Tefillah. Could have been somewhere else. Kadesh she'aruch avifil kol. So everybody should know it. Why? Because the assumption is everybody davens. If you made it, I don't know, if you made it at some other ritual, we wouldn't do it. We daven three times a day. So we put it in tefillah because three times a day we want the Jews to pray for the destruction of the heretics. It really, I don't know. Okay. Nimsu kol ha'bracha shav tefillah shashrei brachot. So now we find out there really are in the Nimsu. We find that now it's not 18 brachot, it's 19 brachot. So that's I just think it's a very powerful Rambam that he summarizes what we discussed. It's interesting, he doesn't mention Shmuel HaKatan making it, but it's because it's Rabban Gamliel who asked him to do it, and that's the source of Vilna Mashini. We say three times a day. Okay. Let's just notice something interesting. Vilna Mashini. So this and only one other bracha, Vilna Yerushalayim Ircha, the only two brachot that start with a vav. Every bracha, right? Atachonein, Rifa'enu, Tekah B'Shofar, Hashiveinu, Slach Lanu. There's no vav and. Right? So why does this bracha start? Vilna Malshinim. What do you mean? And what do you mean? Each bracha is kind of independent. That's why there's no vav. There is an order to the brachot. There we've discussed, of course. And now we're in the second half, the national brachot. But why is there a vav here? Anybody know?
Well, what's the bracha right before it?
Hashiva Shofteinu Karishona. That God should restore our justice system. Ohev Tzedaka Umishpat. And these are like, I guess, you know, right. There's no obvious connection to the two brachot. Yeah, of course, there's some, every bracha in some way is connected, but we have to have justice and we have to destroy the righteous. That's part of the justice system, so to speak. But there's we don't have any bracha.
There's some words censored.
Yeah, so that's this. I believe that's the scholarly answer. Thank you, Morris. That this Vilna Malshinim wasn't the original word. They're different versions of what exactly it started. Lemeshumadim, that some say. We've mentioned, I think many people know, this is assumed to be, most scholars assume, this was initially a bracha against Hebrew Christians, against Jews who believed in Jesus, and believed in Jesus that was the Messiah, but we're observant Jews, you know, they came to shul, like, it's not a crazy thing, you know, it's only later on that the Christian church broke from the, you know, from Judaism. But there was clearly other words, and this was censored. And a Malshin is an informer, right? Malshin is an informer. It's not clear, I mean, who exactly it's referring to. They, in El Bogan's book, Jewish Liturgy, I've mentioned it before. This is I don't know if anybody has this book at home. This is written by Izamar Elbogen, and I believe he was a German Reform rabbi, you know, passed away quite a while ago. The English translation, oh, was it done in 1992? I think the book, I have to find out exactly. And it's a sort of, he goes through with the manuscripts and difference, you know, with the origins of the prayer and in this, you know, in the Roman, the Italian rite and the, you know, all the various things. Consider one of the scholarly books on the Siddur. So he quotes there the church fathers who said that the Jews, the non-Jews consider this, of course, an attack on Christianity, which in some way it was, but I think it was really more attack on the Jews who were practicing Christianity. But, you know, for the Christians, they said the Jewish people are cursing the Christians three times a day, and that's a terrible thing. And we know there's tons of things that have been either censored by the non-Jews or the Jews self-censored. There's a lot of stuff we censored, so the non-Jews shouldn't accuse us of doing all kinds of things. But anyways, it seems pretty clear that here the Vav is because we don't have the original bracha. We'll have to discuss why the Vav in Yerushalayim Yircha. That's a not for that reason. But when we get there, hopefully in a few weeks. Okay. It's interesting. He also notes that Christians didn't have any public prayer. There were no churches, whatever you want to call it, in the first century. They prayed with Jews. They had no choice. I don't know exactly when the first churches developed, but they had no, the only place they could go pray, and they were, you know, as we say, they were observant people. And it's a harsh prayer, as we've mentioned. It's very harsh. Ta'aker, you know, just the language. Just think about it here. Where's the language here? Ta'aker is to uproot. Tishaber, break. Timager, to throw them. Tachnia, to put them down. It's very strong language. Shover oivim, umachnia, you break the enemies. And zedim, who are zedim? Zedim is from the word mezid. On purpose, right? They're shogeg machniyazid. In other words, they're purposely out to harm the Jewish religion. I saw, I believe, in the Otzer HaTfilot Siddur, he quotes that Zedim, very interesting, is Amalek. So I don't know if he means like the original Amalek, or he means Amalek in the sense that we use it today, the descendants of Amalek. You know, there's a famous Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, based on a analysis of the Rambam. He didn't make it up, like, just because it's, you know, it sounds nice. He says the Rambam writes that the seven nations no longer exist. The mitzvah to destroy the seven nations that were in Israel, Knani, Amori, Prizi, Vusi, Girgasi, whatever, they don't exist. Bas Sancheriv Bilbel HaTalmud. Sancheriv, when the Assyrians exiled the 10 tribes, Sancheriv, he mixed everybody up, like kind of what Yosef did, sort of. You know, you move people around, you mix them up, and Ammonia, you know, Amori, and that's why we don't know who's who, and therefore the Talmud says even an Ammoni man, like Ruth was a Moabite woman, right? A Moabite below Moabite, we could convert them. But today we have no idea who a Moabi man or Moabi woman is, and therefore we can marry them and all kinds, you know, no issues. Okay, we can, that's for another time, that's a halakhic acceptable, that's a halakhic idea, that Sancheriv mixed everybody up. But the Rambam, in the next halakha, I didn't have it here because I didn't think I would talk about it. In the next halakha, the Rambam talks about Amalek. There's a mitzvah to wipe out the seven nations. Amalek is not one of the seven nations. That's why they're so bad. In other words, we understand why people living in Israel would want to go to war with the Jewish people. We're taking over that. I don't want to talk politics, but we understand why Palestinians don't like Jews. I get it. There are Arabs living in Israel. They feel, rightly or wrongly, they feel we're taking their territory. We mistreat them. But what does Iran have to do with anything? They're not even Arab. Why does Iran have against us? They're, you know, hundreds of miles away. So that's like much worse. So Amalek, we didn't pass by Amalek. We didn't ask in the desert to pass through. They weren't in Israel. That's much worse. So Amalek's a separate category. And the Rambam doesn't say the wording by, he uses the Shivat Amim, the seven nations, Kvar Avad Zichram. Their memory is no longer. They're lost. We don't know who they are. But the Rambam does not use that language by Amalek. So some say, okay, he doesn't have to. He doesn't have to say it once. It's obvious. The same thing applies. But no, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said, no, the Rambam's being very exact, that Amalek still exists. We still have Amalek. Even if we don't know who they are biologically, people who want to destroy the Jewish people for no reason. The errors wouldn't be Amalek. For no reason, you know, I think Rav Chaim added, they don't believe in God. They have to have, Velo Yarei Elohim, right? They deny God. Whatever, you know, communist Russia, I think maybe that's what he was referring to. I don't know exactly, has a status of Amalek, whatever that means. But we do have in our tradition, and we just got very harsh things to say about that. It came up at the end of last class, right? What we say about people who violate the Shabbat. And today we have different attitudes. We discussed that a little bit last week, but this, you know, enemies have to be dealt with. And we quoted Rabbi Herring's article. There is room. He claims that Jewish tradition does say, Bavod Rishayim Rina. It's not only being Folei Bechal Tismach. We don't only say when your enemy falls, don't rejoice. We say that. But we also say when evil is eradicated, you have to be happy and rejoice. And obviously those two contradict each other, and you have to sort of balance and find out which is which. But so this is a bracha on Bavod Rishayim Rina, that when evil is destroyed, we're very happy and we enjoy, and it's a prayer. But you see in the Rambam, this was a threat to the continuation of Judaism. And it reminds me, the Rambam writes on the Karaites. You know, for many years, the Karaites were a serious threat to Judaism. And the Karaites, they don't have nice things to say about the Karaites. Today, has anybody ever been to a Karaite shul or been in the Karaite community? So you go, they have one in the old city. I haven't ever been inside. Karaites are like nice. When Daniel Lasker, I believe, gave on Torah Motion a couple years ago, a 3-part series on the Karaites. It was fascinating. It was really fascinating. They weren't some idiots, or they just read the Bible fundamentally literalist. Of course, they had a whole theology, and it was weak because we're not threatened by the Karaites. So there are a few thousand of them. There are some left. They're in San Francisco. They have a shul in Israel. They have. But it's like a curiosity. These are interesting Jews. They were once part of our community. They didn't accept the Orah Law. But when the Karaites outnumbered the Rabbanites, which is probably true for quite a bit of time, that the Karaites were bigger and stronger, they were a real threat, a real, real threat. And therefore, we had very terrible things to say about them. The Rambam, interestingly, says, though, this is very important for nowadays, and all the entire Kiruv movement is based on this Rambam, that the Rambam says, yeah, we don't like the Karaites. And if they fall into a pit, you don't save their life on Shabbos, and they're like awful people. But that's only the founders of Karaism. Those who were educated went to a Karaite school. What do you want from them? They were brought up as Karaites. So we can't, we have to love them. We have to be closer to them. So this is, of course, this is a very important Rambam in Hilchot Mamrim, that we can only be upset at the people who make a break with Judaism. Somebody brought up that way. How far do you extend the Rambam? I mean, if people are brought up, you know, in Gaza to hate Jews, like from the time they nursed their mother's milk, like, I don't know who's like, if you think about these things, it's very, you know, yes, we're all products of how we're brought up, and therefore, you know, what do you want? But the Rambam does say that we can't be upset at the children of the Karaites, because that's how they were brought up. That's how they were educated. And obviously, so we have to reach out to them. And that's really the basis of the Kiruv movement. It reminds me of the Rambam in a verse. I don't think I mentioned this, but tell me if I did on Christmas time. So the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah says, you know, you're not allowed to do business with an idolater 3 days before their festival, because idolater is a nice religious idolater. He's going to close $1 million deal with you. He's going to go to his church on Christmas Day, and he's going to announce, I'm giving $200,000 to charity. I just closed a business with Goldberg, and he's such a nice Jewish boy. And because of that nice business deal, we can now dedicate our church and make it nicer. So that's really because we're afraid 3 days are going to go and thank God, their gods, for their business. So it's an amazing Mishnah. So, of course, Tosfot bothered We all do that. You don't go shopping on Friday in a store owned by a Christian. That's 3 days before his festival. So that's a toast with you. What is this? So he has all kinds of answers. We've discussed the answer. Christians aren't idolaters. We don't consider them idolaters anymore. We once did. So anyway, things change. It's people don't realize things change. Our attitudes towards Christianity today, we generally don't consider them idolaters. Whether that's because we see idolatry as a moral sin and it's different for whatever the reasons beyond what we're discussing now, though I guess it is related to the bracha. But one of the answers Tosfot give, which is like, wow. Like you read this answer, it blows my mind. Tosfot says, yeah, they go to church, but you know why they go to church? Their parents schlep them. They don't really believe in that. Their parents make them go to church, so it doesn't really count. They go and they take their prayer book and they do their whatever, the wine and the blood and Jesus and Mary, but they don't really believe in it because it's just what their parents do. You know, when they get old, so it's like really unbelievable. Well, I don't care about the Christian aspect of what Tosfos says. I care about us. Like there is, what do we practice Judaism because we believe in it, because that's how our parents brought us up? Now it's a fine line. We don't want to give, you know, kids, you have to bring them up in a certain way, but there is something that if the kid has no choice, if you're just forced to do something, that's why the Amish, right? Don't they give them a week off or a year off? I know, correct me, I once asked before.
A year
off, right? So we don't do that. We don't.
Ringsprungen.
I'm sorry.
I think it's called Ringsprungen or something like that.
What language is that?
Amish.
Oh, that's okay. Okay.
It's a form of German.
But I think that's a really powerful idea. That so you see that in our tradition a lot. We can't get upset at people who are raised in a certain way. Really, the application of this is, is really, you have to think about it. It's really quite powerful. But the Vilamashini was composed in the time that people were doing it. In other words, they were that first generation. And, it's full of hate. So anyways, so listen, what can we expect? There are certain things, no matter how you're raised, we expect a certain, you know, that's a debate. And philosophers and religion, is there natural morality? Can we expect people to be more without the Torah? And I think the Torah's answer is pretty clear. When Avram says to Abimelech, Abimelech says, why did you lie about your wife, saying she's your sister? Well, Rak ain yirat Elohim b'makom hazeh. We have that a few times. Embrace it. They didn't fear God. What do they fear God? God didn't reveal themselves. They weren't assigned any mitzvot. They didn't get a Torah. What do you want from them? No, there's an understanding as a human being. You have a natural moral sense that you should know. And anyway, so the
most. You have it in this week's parsha.
Yeah, of course you have it in this week's parsha. Shifrem Puah. Thank you. Especially if we assume they are not Jewish. Thank you very much. Yes, absolutely. So that's, how this all plays in, I don't know. But we have to balance this. I think we are in a time where, you know, the idea that praying for hate is difficult for us. It should be difficult. That's why Shmuel HaKatan had to compose it, because Shmuel HaKatan was the one who said, "Be very sad when your enemies fall, you know, are hurt." So, anyways, I don't know. I don't know exactly what we're supposed to think about when we say Vilam Malshinim today. Who the Malshinim? But I guess we talk about the enemies of the Jewish people. But it's mainly the internal. Although it was talking about the Christians, but not necessarily Christians as Christians. Christians as ex-Jews. We know throughout Jewish history being a Malshin, sort of like compared to being a Moser, one who tells the people, and that's how some of the I think Rav Soloveitchik has it. These people came to Shul, and then they would report to the Romans what the Jews are doing, very negative, and then they would hurt the Jew, then they would persecute the Jews. That's a Malshin. So we had no pity on them. Being a Moser, right? Everybody knows, or especially people who grew up in Europe, the worst thing you could tell the Jew, he's a Moser. He hands over Jewish property, even only Jewish property, to non-Jewish authorities. They would kill you. That's the Wazalach, a Moser. It's very important to point out, according to, my poskim, whatever our poskim, today in a democracy, there's very little Masira, if anything. And I know there was, it was in one of the RJJ journals, Journals of Halacha in Contemporary Society, where somebody was arrested, you know, these, religious guys, quote unquote, were arrested, I don't know, India or Japan for smuggling, you know, they did something illegal and they were caught. So the Frum community raises money. Let's get them out of jail. And they asked the Rav Shlomo Zalman Aruch. The Rav Shlomo Zalman Aruch said, what do you mean get money to get them in jail? They belong in jail. Your money, so they'll stay in jail. Well, what do you mean? You break the law in Canada, the United States. We're two different countries. I just want to make that clear to everybody. Canada and the United States. So you break the law, you go to jail. You have to pay. And that's why Rav Moshe Feinstein says you can be a prosecuting lawyer, a district attorney. You're gonna turn Jews in. Okay, if they break the law, they have to be punished. Mesira is dealing in times where we're dealing with a government that persecutes Jews. That's a very different story. We're not in that situation, thank God, anymore. Despite the rise in anti-Semitism, it's still, there's no comparison. Okay, let's move on. Unless anybody has any questions. Yes.
How can anyone say Shifra and Pur were Egyptians? It says Beferish the Pasuk that
he no, a male dot Hebrewot couldn't mean the male dot for the Hebrewot.
Right, male dot could be. Right.
Male dot, yeah. So that's the commentaries are split 50-50. Half of them say they were Jewish, half of them say they're Egyptian. Now, I always think, and all these debates, so they interpret male dot Hebrewot were the midwives for the Hebrews, not Hebrew midwives, right? That's unclear. The coin, why does the Torah make it unclear? That's the real question. The Torah could have made it clear that, but the Torah wants to show there are two ways. I'm in the middle. That's what my Dvar Torah, I think, is going to be about. It can be, sometimes it's non-Jews who save us and sometimes Jews who save us. In other words, we should understand the story. Shifra and Pua were Jewish, one way to understand the story. Shifra and Pua are not Jewish, it's another way to understand the story. The Torah does this 5 million times. Every other verse in the Torah that there's a debate, when Rashi and Ramban argue what it means, each one knows the other one could be right. The Torah did that on purpose. The Torah wants them to debate. That's a thing that we don't teach enough. In other words, when all this debate about every 99.9%, who sold Yosef? Rashi, we were all taught, everybody was raised, the brother sold Yosef, the Rashbam. And the more pshat is, it wasn't the brothers, it was the Mijanim. While the brothers were discussing what to do, Vayavru Anashim Mijanim Socharim Vayam Shichu, they pulled him out. Well, who's they? The they should be the meaning, not the brothers who were mentioned earlier. But why does the Torah make that unclear? Because the Torah wants us to understand the story one way. Yosef saw, the brothers sold, and it's a different story if they sold, because the Torah doesn't care about historical events. The Torah's not written for what happened, or is written for us, for a moral lesson. So who cares? I don't care. Yaakov and Esav, was Yaakov, when he stole the bracha, was he right or wrong? The Torah is ambiguous. Now we know he suffered again.
Rabbi Jay, yes. The brothers were there.
The brothers what?
The brothers were there when somebody else pulled them out.
No, they were eating lunch. They were eating lunch.
Don't give them points. Don't give them points. They never ask mechila or slicha. Never did.
Right. So that's okay. I don't want to get into parsha of Shavuot too much, but yes,
we are suffering.
Did Yaakov Avinu ever find out what happened? Very unclear. The simple meaning, he unlikely that he found out, but we don't know for sure. And right, lots of things we don't know. And the Torah leaves it there on purpose for us to think. We fill in the blank. And every person and every generation and for different communities, it makes sense to fill in the blank this way. And for a different community, it makes sense to fill out the blank a different way. That's what we mean. Shivim panim l'Torah. There's 70 faces to the Torah. The Torah is purposely vague. It's purposely unclear. So that's on purpose. Yeah, what Susan's saying, the Chama Livu, it says, I don't know that she quotes that view. I don't know that she agrees. No way we part tell Jewish midwives. Yeah, that's, I forget how they deal with that question. Right. That's why we assume they aren't Jewish. The reason say they're not Jewish, how could he tell Jewish midwives to do that? But I don't know. Is that true 100%?
Avi Weiss.
She was strong about that. She was strong that they weren't Jewish.
Okay, right. And Rashi assumes they're Yocheved and Miriam, of course, the Midrash. Shifra, Yocheved and Miriam. And Bayas them, Batim, Bate Kuna, Bolivia. I mean, Rashi takes the very, but you're right. I have to look that up. I don't remember. But it's both. It's unclear. Yes.
The Torah gives lots of clues that they were Jewish. It says later on that they feared God.
That's so what? That could, who so what does that have to do with being
why
Jewish?
Why would Egyptians fear our God?
Well, who said they feared our God? They feared there's one.
They feared God. The Pesuk says Beferish. They feared Hashem.
Batirena Meodot Elohim or something. So Elohim is the God of nature. God.
The Pesuk, yeah, read the Pesuk.
Not just your God.
Furthermore, their names are Semitic names. They wouldn't be Egyptians.
What do you mean?
Moshe
has an Egyptian name. I don't know. The names, though, I don't know.
They are Semitic names. They're not Egyptian names.
I have no idea. That I don't know. All I know is we'll have to move on and leave that for later. But all I know is the Mefarshim are split 50-50. I don't know exactly 50-50. But yes, a significant portion say they were Jewish, and a significant portion. My point is, I don't care if they were Jewish or not Jewish. It's not relevant. The Torah leaves it that we can read the story both ways. With that, that's all we have to do. We have to read the story both ways, and it's a slightly different story. And then you have to answer the question, but they're Jewish, how can part do that? You know, what are they doing? Yeah, how to fearing God. But non-Jews, when Avram told Avimelech, that I just quoted, Rak ein yirat Elohim b'makom hazeh, there's no fear of God. He's talking to non-Jews. He's not talking to Jews. The fear of God is something we expect everybody to have. One of the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach is not to do idolatry, to believe there's a God. V'nemar v'yashem l'melech ha'kol ha'aretz, everybody's going to accept God. We won't all be Jewish. We're not going to be Jewish. We're just going to accept there's one God. We don't even want them to become Jewish, right? We make it hard to convert. We just want them to acknowledge that there's a God in the world. There's morality. And that's why that's the Dennis Prager famous, you know, he always would quote, if you're walking home alone at night, you know, and you're going in an alley and you see 10 burly guys coming towards you, would you feel more relieved if you found that they just came from a Bible class? A church Bible class. So we all would feel relieved. But if you lived in the 1400s, you wouldn't feel relieved. You feel they're coming from the church, they may kill you. Things change. We understand today. We think it's good. I think it's terrible that Christmas is all materialistic. Primarily, I don't know exactly. Obviously, I don't. But, you know, how many Christians go to church on Christmas Day? It's about presents and the tree and the this and the that. That's not Christmas. Christmas is a religious holiday. Because secularism is a religion. It's just a much worse religion, you know. So I much prefer the non-Jews go to church. Yeah, sometimes you have religions that are very anti-Jewish. So that's a problem. Extreme Islam, that's idolatry. But normal Islam, you know, many Muslims are not anti-Jewish. Generally, religion today, that's the Meiri's whole point. Christianity today teaches to be a moral person, to be a good person. They're not idolaters. They believe in three gods. Big deal. That's between them. That's not our problem. Religion is it's fascistically. I don't mean like for us. It's a problem. But that's the Meiri's famous idea that if a religion teaches moral values, that's not idolatry by definition. Okay, can we move on to Al Hatzadikim?
I just wanted to say that Avi Weiss writes about this in he has a book called Loving Torah.
Okay.
And that Sforno says that it was non-Jewish Mieldot, and Rashi writes that it was Jewish Mieldot.
Right.
It's a reflection of their time.
Ah, of course. So I was just saying, Sforno was known to be very close to, I think one of his very good friends was a Christian priest, or I don't know the whole story there, I have to look it up, but absolutely we're influenced by our Sforno. Yes, my uncle used to tell me that. My uncle founded, Prospect Park, the school in New York. My uncle would often say that you find very negative attitudes towards non-Jews in the Talmud and very much more positive. And he would say often it depended when they lived. You know, if you went through the Holocaust, like my grandfather, I mentioned this before, my grandmother would tell me if she ever brought in a Polish cleaning lady, my grandfather would have killed her. I mean, you know, because he lost, members of his family, Poland, and, you know, that's just terrible. I grew up in Canada, a beautiful country. We want to keep it that way, right? Non-Jews are nice people, and it's very different. And they said that's in the Talmud. So obviously you're going to have, Rashi grew up under persecution. Absolutely. He's going to have a very negative view. That's, if you're a human being, you're influenced. I know in yeshivas, they don't like to say that because they think Torah is somehow totally, but it's not true. We're all human beings. Yes, Yocheved.
Rabbi Kelman?
Yeah.
You're just reminding me many, many years ago, I went to Foster Park. So in 12th grade, your uncle gave the Pirkei Avos class.
Okay.
And I remember finding it fascinating at the time because we really weren't exposed to this. He taught it to us. He first gave us the background of each Tana, whoever was saying whatever he was saying. He was showing the connection between their time or the way they're described in the Gemara and what they said. So,
thank you. Michael was a special person, really. He was, unfortunately he was orphaned. My grandfather, who I'm named for, passed away when my father was 9. Michael was 15. My grandmother raised 6 kids in the 1930s in Depression years. And, whatever. But my uncle was really, he was more modern than Prospect Park is today, that's for sure. And by the way, just one other thing I'll say, just interesting talking about Christian and influence and all that. He went to University of Toronto, my uncle. They were living in Toronto. They moved to New York, my father came back to Toronto. So he went to University of Toronto in the 1940s. And in those days, you see, you had to take courses in Bible as a requirement. You know, you had to take a well-rounded education. And of course, the Bible was taught from a critical perspective, the documentary hypotheses, etc. And my uncle told me it actually strengthened his faith. It was the first time in his life he had to face serious questions. These were not idiots. These professors are not stupid people. They're raising serious questions, many of which were raised by our rabbis. Chazal raised many of these problems. And Rabbi Yishmael, we see every day the rabbis were aware. Of course, the Torah contradicts itself. But he said he was forced to sort of study the Torah and to find the traditional response. That just found interesting. Some people, you're right, if you're never exposed to Dilko, they'll become apikorsim, obviously. That's why, we believe it's good to expose people to all kinds of things. I think most of the people here believe that. You know, if you're totally, totally sheltered and then you throw into the University of Toronto, somebody talk about documentary hypothesis, then you really can lose your entire faith. That goes without saying. But if you are prepared for it, so I think that was a fascinating thing. I remember him telling me it's strengthened his faith that he had a study, he had that university professors telling him. He also told us, if I can say that, my mohel, those who live in Toronto know Dr. Cass, who did all the, was in his class. And I heard this from Dr. Cass himself when he was giving a Gemara Shir once. And Dr. Cass said he had to take this course in university on biblical criticism. And he wrote at the bottom of this essay he had to hand in, their final paper. He wrote, long after your bones are rotting in hell, the truth of the Torah will be proven. So that takes a young kid with chutzpah to write it, especially some of you applying to medical school. I don't know if I would write that, but he got into medical school, and then he was the mohel for thousands of babies in Toronto, including me myself. So it was a different era. Today, what can I tell? Okay, can we, Al HaTzadikim, let's discuss. Okay, any other comments, questions? It's supposed to be on the Siddur, what can we do? Judaism, every Kol HaTorah Kula Inyan Achadi, right? That's the entire Torah is one topic. There's a expression like that. I forget where that is. Rav Shechter used to quote that. Said there's no such thing as, what do you mean you're off topic? The entire Torah is one topic. Okay. Al HaTzadikim, Val HaChasidim, Val Zignei Amcha Beit Yisrael. The total opposite. We just were praying hatred, destroy our enemies, destroy those people, our talebearers. Now we're going to pray for the righteous. Of course, this was here. The Mishnah was an add-on. Now we're going to pray. So it's not like it wasn't composed in response, for sure. There's no vav, but it's not composed in response to Mishnah because this is way, way hundreds of years earlier. So we'll go through all the chasidim, tzaddik, chasid, ziknei amcha, pleita, sofreim, geirat, tzedek, aleinu. They're basically six types of people who get back there. There's a tzaddik, a chasid, ziknei amcha, the elders of the Jewish people, pleita, sofreihem, the remnants of the scribes, whatever that means, Geirei HaTzedek, converts, Reich converts, that's fine. Aleinu, and us, normal, regular people, we're without any special, not tzaddikim, not chassidim, regular Jews. It's like whoever says this, we're always Aleinu. In other words, somebody else is a chassid, and we should never think that we're the tzaddik, the chassid, right? Aleinu, and us, and then we say, oh, God have mercy on us. So first of all, I believe, I didn't count every word, but if you look, well, here I did count every word, but if you look, I believe this is the longest bracha of the 13 brachot in the middle part. Obviously, modim's longer, but that's not really this part of the Shemone Esrei, right? Atachonein is short. Hashiveinu Avinu is short. Tzlach Lanu is short. Ravenu is a little longer, but it's not quite as long. Lomashim is also a little longer. Vili Rishalayim is short. Etzemach David is short. They're all very short. Shema Koleinu a little bit longer. So this is the longest bracha. I don't know if it means anything. Just, I guess we're praying for the righteous. They need a lot of our prayers. I don't know. Whatever. Praying for six types of people. I really mentioned it because in the tour, he quotes, this is the longest. How many words? Anybody know how many words there are? So Zev, we're going to have a different count for words. Nusach Chabad, Nusach Sfar, but in the nice Nusach Ashkenaz Siddur that the tour used and I'm using, how many words anybody know? 42 words. So 42 is right, one of the names of God, the significance. We're not so into this, but there's a whole school of thought that, they would count words. As a matter of fact, sofrehem, what's vaplektat sofrehem? What's a sofer? The Gemara says, you know what a sofer is? They would spore, they would count the letters of the Torah. They would count, I shouldn't have actually brought the Gemara, but maybe we'll see all if I have a chat. They were called sofrim, the Gemara, because they actually counted. Now, I don't know, literally, I guess it means a little literal, but it means they knew the Torah like backwards and forward. They knew the Torah by heart. And of course, a scribe, it's the same. A scribe has to know every single letter. They would count the letters. So the Gemara has a discussion. What's the middle letter of the Torah? So this one says this, this one says, I don't understand. Take out a Sefer Torah and count. I mean, what's the middle? Today you don't have to count. Put it in a computer. How many letters? I don't know. How many words are in the Torah? 305,000 or something words in the Torah? And figure it out. So you know what the Gemara says? We can't do that because we're not so sure. We're not b'ki'im, b'chaserot v'yateirot. We don't know when there is a vav, when there isn't a vav. Our Torah may have a vav. The Torah of Sinai may not have a vav. This is one of the famous Gemaras that they used to show that the Rambam couldn't have meant that every single letter came from Sinai or that the Torah we have today because the Gemara says it black and white. We don't know. We're not Bikim. We're not experts. And the Gemara says they had three Sifrei Torah in the Azara in the temple. And when there was a question, what's the right word? They would look in the three in the Torah and they would, if two of the three said like that, that's what they would use. In other words, they didn't agree. And I've mentioned many times, they're very minor differences, but still, we don't have agreed upon Sefer Torah that everyone agrees to. Communities, the Yemenite community has their own Sefer Torah. I think there are nine differences. I'm not up on this 100%. But anyways, the Sofrim were the people who counted the letters, who knew, or gets later on understood, what's Divrei Sofrim? What's Divrei Sofrim? So we read the Megillah, our obligation to hear the Megillah on Purim is Midivrei Sofrim. Midivrei Sofrim from the words of the rabbis. I mean, it's rabbinic law, usually derived from something in Tanakh. So Divrei Sofrim, the Sofrim are the people who interpreted the Torah. They counted the letters, they knew the letters, they wrote the Torah letter by letter, but they were the ones who interpreted the Torah. That's how many, the Divrei Sofrim are the experts in Torah Shebaal Alpeh. But anyway, so that's, so there was this notion that the Tfilot should have exact words. We don't play around with the words. I think this, the Hasidic Ashkenaz were into this. I think in Kabbalistic literature, which I know nothing about, this is important stuff, like to have exact words. And that's, you don't just add words here. I think today we're not as, necessarily as careful. And for sure, Nusach Sfar, that changed a lot of the words and different things. But anyways, whatever. This is the longest bracha, 42 words. Okay. And in a sense, Vilam al Shinim and al Hatzadikim is the notion of Surmei Rava Aseitov. The way we have it today, first we pray to get rid of evil, kafrika the evil, and then asay tov. So the vaoshilim is like surmei ra, and al hatzadikim is asay tov. Okay, so what's the difference between a tzadik and a chassid? So you can say in a lot of these things, they mean the same thing. You know, this the Torah repeats itself often. So we were all trained, and it's a nice thing. The Torah there's always a reason for repetition. It's not, Rabbi Shmuel doesn't agree with that. Even Ezra doesn't agree with that. There are strands in our tradition. Divrat Torah kilshom b'nei adam, which I'm sure most of you also heard. The Torah speaks in the language of men. So the Torah repeats it had changed the word here because that's how people speak. You never say the exact same words. When you tell over the same story five times, each time it's the same story, but you're going to say different words. So that's what the Ibn Ezra says. The Ibn Ezra goes so far to say that by the Aseret HaDibrot, they're different. Who cares? It doesn't mean anything. This is like, wow. And the Chamalibutz could not stand that approach. Wow. She so much didn't like that approach. The Rashi approach, the approach we were brought, every word, every letter, that's the Rabbi Akiva approach, every et. But that's Rabbi Yishmael says, no, he didn't agree with that approach. So, you know, it's, but even if you take Rashi's approach at every word and every letter, still it may add something, but it's done as a repetition. It's done as emphasis. It's done for poetic reasons, all kinds of reasons. So often, tzaddikim, chassidim, it's saying the same thing many different ways. The righteous people should have mercy upon them. So on a certain level, we're just saying the same thing a number of times. But of course, each one has a unique meaning, although different commentaries have different, exactly what the difference is. But I think the standard difference. What's the difference between a tzaddik and a chassid? And we're not talking about the Hasidim of the Baal Shem Tov, right? This is before the Baal Shem Tov. And so I'm sorry to disappoint, right? It's, you know, I think that's obvious for us. But, you know, I think often it isn't obvious to people because they're as soon as they see the word chassid, you know, an image pops in their mind. I think we all instinctively, I probably even do, we all do that. It's somehow, I don't know, you tell me if you don't, but it's you know, pops into our mind, a chassid, you know, the payas and the bekish and the gartel, you know. But anyways, that's how Moshe Rabbeinu dressed, obviously. Right. So, what is it? A tzaddik and a chassid. So I'm going to start with since nobody wants to speak up yet so soon, I'm going to start with the Rambam's definition of a tzaddik, which is probably not the way most people understand this here, but I quoted it before, but just to see it inside, it's like really, it's really cool. The Rambam's so amazing, you know, always. Okay. So the Rambam says like this, this is in Hilchot Shuva. Just a little bit before Hilchot Tefillah, chapter 3. Kol echad v'echad mibnei adam yesh lo zechuyot v'amidot. Every single person, a bnei adam, again, remember that term adam that we saw before. Adam means humanity, Jews and non-Jews. When he wants to say Jews, it's bnei Israel. Adam is always the reference to humanity. Every human being has good points and bad points, has merits and sins. That's what it means to be a human. Misha zechuyotav yeterot al avonotav. One who has more merits than demerits is a tzaddik. But one who has more demerits than merit points, he's a rasha. 50% plus one, either way. Mechsa al mechsa, that's like a little bit hard. 50-50. Exactly 50-50. You're a benoni. I mean, that's right. And according to the Rambam, Aseret Yemei Teshuva is only for benonim. We're supposed to think we're Benonim, but the chances that any of us are Benonim are like 1 in 50 million. I mean, what do you have, 50-50? Like everything you do the whole year, you're exactly the same? And good about that's like next to impossible. And then the Rambam says this is true by every nation. We judge not only individuals, we judge nation. And the Rambam then goes on, and the Rambam, of course, it says it's not just a numerical count. There's a qualitative count. What does he say? She calls it a nolafim minyan. It's not just numbers. It's according to their good lam, how big they are. Yeshchut, there's some merits that knocks out 10. One mitzvah can get you 10 points and, you know, you need 10 sins against it. Or chas v'shalom, the opposite. Yeshavon, some sins are so great. It's not, you can't just do any, you know, eat kosher meal sometime and you knock it out. So that's, on the only one who knows the count, of course, is God. That's the only one. So obviously, like, we pretend we're Benonim, but that's the Rambam's definition of a tzaddik. If you're a little better, If you know, you're 51% good. I think in many ways that's very reassuring. It's also depressing because you become a Rasha at 51%. But hopefully it's not so hard. Now, what the Rambam says, the count, I think it's important to point out that the Meshech Chokhma says that, you know, mitzvot take on historical importance. At different historical times, mitzvot have different historical meanings. It's a little bit, on the surface, sound radical. This is the Meshech Chokhma, died in 1926, the great, the Or Sameach, wrote the Or Sameach on the Rambam, the Meshech Chokhma on the Chumash. And he actually, it's next week's Parsha, you know, the famous Medrash, that why were we redeemed from Egypt? Because whatever, the various Midrashim, we didn't change our names, our language, our clothing, different things the Medrash says. So here we are. I dress like, you know, regular non-Jew. I'm speaking English. And my name is Jay. I violated every one of the famous Midrashim. Like, I don't deserve to be redeemed from Egypt. That's, you know, like, I what's going on here? So Rav Moshe Feinstein deals with that. He said, no big deal. He says, that's before there was a Torah. When there was no Torah, what kept us as Jews? Your Jewish name, your Jewish language. Once there's a Torah, I got Shabbos, Kashrus, Tvilin, Mezuzah, Shabbos. I don't need a Jewish name. Not so important. And look, many of our great rabbis and them with a non-Jewish name. So I'm Jay. We all grew up in the generation, not all of us. I can look at some of your names, but, you know, many we grew up, we all have English names. Many of us have English names. And, our kids all have Hebrew names. No, that's, times change. So the Meshech Chokhma there discusses that mitzvot take on different historical importance. At different times, at that time that was mitzvah, and sometimes the least important mitzvot become very important, and the most important mitzvot are not so important, and it changes. Rav Schachter uses this idea when he wrote the article 40 years ago on the mitzvah of living in Israel. He said, our generation, the mitzvah to live in, there was a mitzvah in the 1200s to live in Israel too. All right, so he moved to Israel, big deal. Like, you starved, and there was no economy. Like somebody had to send you money from, Kutzart. You didn't accomplish so much. Today, it's, you build up, a country. You can even do that from here on a certain level. But the historical notion of mitzvot change. I think that's just an important concept. We live in the real world. Torah is meant for the real world. Of course, all mitzvot are binding, if they're practical, they're binding at all time. But how important they are really can vary with what's going on in the world around us. Okay. That's a very important point. But what's the classical so what is the difference between, a tzaddik means you do more good than bad. I guess everybody agrees, but we normally think of a tzaddik, and I think that's the measure. Well, as a matter of fact, one of the Mefarshim, I forget who said, someone who never sins. Well, what do you mean someone who never sins? There's no such creature. So it means someone who's a tzaddik. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Moshe Feinstein, that's a tzaddik. You know, by the way, you don't want the Chafetz Chaim, right? Everybody knows the famous line, right? You don't want a tzaddik writing a halacha book. I mean that not jokingly. That's what people have said that. When a tzaddik, when the Chafetz Chaim writes a book on halacha, so the Chafetz Chaim is worried about every little opinion, you should never follow it. The classical poskim, I don't want to get into trouble here, also we follow the Aruch HaShulchan, don't follow the Mishnah Berurah. They said, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, for example, the classic idea was the Mishnah Berurah was written for B'nai Yeshiva. People learning in yeshiva, okay, they can be strict like the Mishnah Berurah. Regular people, they don't need the Mishnah Torah. The Chavetz Chaim was such a tzaddik, so there's some view in the middle of nowhere. Don't do this, so the Chavetz Chaim is going to change the halacha, how you can follow each view. Yotzei kol hashitot. He wants to fulfill all obligations, and that's not the classic approach in Psak. We choose, no, I'm being makel. We follow it. So there are opinions who disagree. Big deal. I don't have to worry about every opinion. That's the classic approach to halakha. That was the approach of the Aruch HaShulchan, and that's why the classic idea was that balabatim, normal people, regular people, follow the Aruch HaShulchan. Then yeshiva. Okay. that someone who's a tzaddik, yeah, he should follow. He should be machmir. There is room to be machmir, ala machmir tavo bracha. You get blessed, but that's if you're doing all the basics. So that's, and what's happened today is everybody follows the Mishnah Berurah. I mentioned last week why this is another, you know, why the Mishnah Berurah shouldn't be translated into English. If you don't know Hebrew, you shouldn't be reading the Mishnah Berurah. Mishnah Berurah is not for you if you can't read it in the original. That's my view, but okay, other people will disagree. But so the reason, yeah.
So I would add that perhaps the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is also.
Oh yeah, no, don't mention that book. Don't not mention that book in the 21st yeah. century. If you want to turn someone off, no, I mean this in all seriousness. It maybe it was an appropriate book. It was in Hungary from Shlomo Gonsfri, the big Talmud Chacham, and he wrote a very important book. And for Hungarian Jewry, it was very nice. Sarin Shulchan Aruch. You bring that to American kids. You want to turn off kids of Judaism? Learn the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. I'm sorry. I don't know what else to say. It is.
I just want to point out that many elementary schools, I remember that one because the Hebrew is easy enough for children.
When I was young, when I was in grade 10 in high school, they taught us Kitzur Shulchan Aruch too. And thank God I don't remember anything from it. I don't want to remember anything from it. I don't want to chas v'shalom. Don't misunderstand me. But he's Hungarian Orthodoxy, which is totally different. The most extreme Hungarian Orthodoxy. It's a turnoff to people like me. I don't know. Maybe you're different, but it doesn't speak to American kids. That you have to know. You have to know. Well, Psaki, you have to know here. That's why it's a Mara D'Atra. As we've said 1,000 times, two people ask the same question, get a different response. Because the halakha has to know you, your circumstances. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is not for us. Listen, there are always people, many people are against any code for this reason. Code, I'm not bound by what Rav Yosef Karo, why not to be bound by what Rav Yosef Karo said? Ela shofet asher yeh bayamim ahem. You go to the people of that generation. You don't worry about everything, but we need codes because life, it's too hard otherwise. But there's a lot to be said to be anti-codes, and there's so much in our tradition against it. We sort of have no choice, but the kids are right. So the Chayei Adam is much better than the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And you know the old joke, why did they call it the Chayei Adam? So nobody would write a Kitzur Chayei Adam. Right, okay. All right. You can write a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Nobody's going to write a Kitzur Chayei Adam. Okay? If you don't get the joke, well, what can I do? Chayei Adam means the life of a person. Nobody's going to write a short life. Okay. But it is important that to know what books, so at what stage in life do you give somebody a book about, even not about Tshuva, but especially about Tshuva. You're not going to give them there. This is, I have it here. Happens to be sitting here. I mentioned this book before. Nobody uses this anymore. Give me a second here. To Be a Jew. Anybody read this book? It's a fantastic book. Written in the 70s. Today, maybe it's somehow too, I don't know why. Too modern. It's basics. Aleph of Yiddishkeit.
Is written that by Donin?
Yeah. Yeah. He also wrote the book that I use sometimes here, To Pray as a Jew. I don't have the cover for that one. I think he was a rabbi in Detroit, and then he made Aliyah. I think he passed away a young man, unfortunately. But this was a fantastic book. This is like, basic stuff. Another book I read as a kid, I haven't seen it in years, I don't remember, 8 Questions People Ask on Judaism. You remember that one? Telushkin and Prager. When Dennis Prager was more traditional than he is today, but whatever. Him and Joseph Telushkin, who's written many, many books, many fantastic books. Actually, I give his books often. Here's one of them.
Jewish Literacy.
Our mitzvah present to kids who aren't yeshiva boys. This is one of them. He wrote all these books, The Basic Jewish Wisdom. They're fantastic. They're just basic, Sefer HaTodah. There are all these wonderful books that today, everybody's learning Daf Yomi. They don't have time to learn the basics of Judaism. They're worried about, if you throw the blood here, is it Yosei, the mitzvah? Like a little bit, too many people are learning Daf Yomi. I'm sorry, but Daf Yomi is great because it gets them to learn, but really it's not for many, many people would get much better Jewish education than they learned. And that if they went to a Daf Yomi shir every day, but it just happened not to be on Daf Yomi, what can I tell you? What can I tell you? It works. Daf Yomi for all kinds of reasons, for psychological reasons, it doesn't work, the other stuff. But, so you have all these books that are sort of out of style today, because they're sort of like, like modern, you know, it's the same reason Art Scroll printed its Siddur. They said it right at the beginning, or they did their Chumash. There was a time people were happy with, I don't know, the Hertz Chumash and this. And today, you know, we have a different generation. They want more. The RCA wrote that. Why did the Polo Siddur? They had to replace it. We need a Siddur with more oomph and more explanation. It's a different community. Okay. Anyways, all right. So, it's already 10:15, so we have to stop. So what's a tzaddik? A tzaddik is a tzaddik. The Chafetz Chaim is a tzaddik. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Zalman, you know, you have Rav Moshe Feinstein, right? It's a matter of, see, when we think of Rav Soloveitchik, to finish this thought, really, we don't think of him as a tzaddik, right? No, or we think of the Chafetz Chaim as a tzaddik, right? There are certain images you have of people. That's they said that, I think, what did they say? Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, we think of him as a great Lamdan. He was a genius Lamdan, and he reframed how we do Talmud. He understood, that's the Rav said, things change. We're in the 19th century now, science is picking up, and Jews are falling by the wayside. Judaism is archaic, old-fashioned, can't deal with modern. Science is new and exciting. And that's what the Rav said. The Rav always talked, my grandfather saved Torah. Without my grandfather, nobody would study Talmud, because my grandfather wrote science, classification. It was a scientific approach. That was why he criticized him. What's his name? Who was the chief? It was in Israel, then it was in Chicago. I forget his name now. The Ritvaz. The Ritvaz called Rav Chaim, he's a chemist. That was not a compliment. I mean, when he called Norman Lamas a chemist, that was a compliment. They had a degree in chemistry. But when the Ritvaz called Rav Chaim Soloveitchik a chemist, that was not a compliment, because he had a scientific approach, classification, order, structure, because that's how people think today. So we're going to have to teach Talmud in that way. Brilliant, beautiful. And the Rav, you know, he saved Torah because of that. But we that's what we think of Rav Chaim, brilliant intellectual. But they say Rav Chaim was such a tzaddik. You know, the stories that he took in all the orphans and the Mamzerim into his house. When a single girl got pregnant, he would take her in and raise the baby. He was like a real tzaddik. You know, when the woman came with how much he didn't allow people to daven on Yom Kippur, because there was some Bundes, you know, some Bundes who for sure wasn't fasting on Yom Kippur, was arrested by the Russian. We're not going to daven Yom Kippur. Everybody go home on Yom Kippur, get money. We're going to bribe the official, get money. He was all the sorts of tzaddik. Say his lamdas was so great. Some of us, we don't focus on how much he was a tzaddik. And the same thing, the Chafetz Chaim was, well, there we do, but I forget who they say was such a tzaddik, we don't realize what a great lamdan he was, you know, but they go together. We have different images. Okay, we'll have to pick up, though, really, what's the difference between a tzaddik and a chassid, pick up on that next week, but let's just do a quick review. So we just finished up the bracha v'lemashinim, full of very negativity. Because at the time, as the Rambam said, the future of Judaism was in doubt. That's the way the Rambam seems to present it. They were very nervous. The temple had been destroyed, and now Jews were leaving the fold in droves and becoming other religions, and they were putting spies into the shuls, and a terrible thing. So we had no choice. We had to compose a very, very harsh bracha, which today it's different. We live in a slightly different world. Although there are, unfortunately, people we should say this bracha about, but maybe not Jews. And we discuss the real serious issue. There's a lot of thought. Is what do you do when somebody's brought up in a particular way? How much credit or blame do they get with the Karaites or the Christians or Jews, you know, are brought up, or the Arabs? You're brought up in a particular way. You can't really, you know, there's certain things we expect natural morality, but certain things, you know, that's the way you're brought up. So it's hard, and the halacha does take that into account. How much and where? It's a difficult issue, but something we have to think about. We spoke about the ambiguity of the Torah, who sold Yosef to me, Aldot HaEvriyot, right? The Torah does this on purpose so we can understand it on many levels. I forgot how we got into that, but whatever. And then we discussed, right, the Lamashinim was seen by the church as very negative, as an attack on Christianity, and therefore was censored, and that's why there's a Vav. The Lamashinim, it's at Ula Notzrim, somewhere it actually said the Notzrim, or the Meshumadim, and it says, I think, Elbog, the Meshumadim, Altihi Tikva, the lo yashuv l'Torah techa, right? And all the different ideas, Zaydi might even be Amalek, and that's what we said, Amalek does that still exist? Or yes or no, right? We know the nations aren't the nations, but is Amalek biological or conceptual? I think we all understand there's a conceptual idea to Amalek. Amalek can exist in a non-biological form. And then we just started the bracha of Al Hatzadikim, the Rambam's definition of a tzaddik, not too hard. We can all be tzaddikim. That's a beautiful thing. We can all be Rishayim too, but, and God, and you can't, we have no way to count because, certain mitzvot can be worth 10 averot and vice versa. And they can change, as we said, over historical time. In certain historical time periods, things become more important and less important due to the society we live in. And Torah leaders have to be very appropriate. The tragedy of much of American Jewry is, you know, when people came after the Holocaust, great Torah scholars, and they went into teaching, they had lost the best years of their life, so to speak, and they couldn't relate to American kids. I'm sure some of us had people like that, and it's a tragedy. People left you, not their fault, but, you know, you have to have an American mindset. You know, Rav Soloveitchik had to learn how to play baseball. If you're going to talk to today, maybe they play less baseball. No, but if you want to be a successful, you have to know what's going on. You have to know what's going on in the world, and that means whatever, what interests the kids, you know, whatever. They're, so it's very important rabbis be attuned to the times and to apply Torah that makes sense to people and it's going to inspire people. And, you know, and that's what made Jonathan Sacks a great rabbi. We all know, I don't have to start naming names. We all know people who can relate and great rabbis who can speak in the language. The Brat Torah Kol Shom Bnei Adam, we were using that the Torah may repeat itself. You don't have to worry about everything, but the Brat Torah Kol Shom Bnei Adam is also an imperative to us that we must speak Torah in the language that is understood by people. When Moshe Rabbeinu translated the Torah to 70 languages, it doesn't just mean, you know, into Greek and Arabic and Latin and Spanish. It means the language that speaks to people. 70 different languages. You have to different people. Okay, let's just take any quick questions here. Boker Tov. Were there kinds of prayers into time of Shabbat? I don't know, but we just start, you know, I have to start plugging more. You know, we have the podcast of Jewish Ideas. It's really one of the best. I'm not saying that Store Motion runs it, but it's really phenomenal. It's really, I think it's unique in the Jewish world. J.J. Kempri, we interview fascinating people and such a wide range. You won't find the range we have. So we do it every week or two. We do a new episode. So we just started the first one. I think only the first one was a 5-part series on Shabbat Tzvi. We did a 3-part series on Chabad recently, Zev. I don't know if you listened to that one. Most of them just interviewing fascinating people, very interesting people. But we're doing now a 5-part series on Shabbat Tzvi. I haven't even listened myself yet to the first part. So if you want to know about Shabbat Tzvi, probably they'll answer the question then. Were they? I imagine things were done in time Shabbat Tzvi. I don't know. But you have to realize most rabbis followed Shabbat Tzvi. I know that's like at the time when it happened, and even for maybe 100 years later, that's why Rav Yaakov Emden, who's born 30 years after Shabtai Tzvi dies, 35 years, is still fighting the Sabbateans left and right. So but during Shabtai Tzvi, many, I don't want to say the majority, I'm not necessarily saying that, but many great rabbis, were followers, were believed in Shabtai Tzvi. Okay, they didn't know. Most of them, after he converted to Islam, it changed. So I don't know what prayers came from Shabtai Tzvi, but thank you, that's an interesting question. Yeah, the carrots were not brought to kill us, absolutely, for sure. Morris, Rabbeinu Lau said one of his professors, said Rabbeinu Lau is a Tinoch Shanishpa, as he had no real choice whether or not to be a Frum Jew. So did he mean it that because he's, I get it. Because I thought you say like a Haredi person would say to you, you're modern Orthodox, you're a Tinoch Shanishpa. He was saying it, he's from, there is an element of truth to that. I do believe it. How much choice you want to give people, I don't know where to draw the line. There's absolutely, I tell my kids in chat all the time, had I been raised in a home that didn't keep kosher, I probably wouldn't keep kosher. Like, I don't know, maybe, like, I don't blame them. Like, of course, I was brought up in a certain home, so that's who I am. We want to do that. Shema b'ni musar avicha. On the other hand, yeah, Morris, what do you want to say?
The professor was reacting to, you know, that from people say that, non-from people are excused from doing this foot because they were not Shanishpa. So he was reacting to that.
He's right. He's right. I agree with him 100%. I agree with him. Absolutely.
Your life. Yeah.
I agree. He's right. He's right. The trick is, so even though we were brought up, but we have to believe it on our own. It's got to be in our kishkas. Absolutely, it's right. That's what I'm saying. We're all, when Tosfot says, don't blame the Christians, they're just following their parents. That's a muster for us. Like, if you're just following your parents, like, on the other hand, we want our kids to follow what we do. So it's, but yes, he is right. What you think of the people brought up in Bnei Brak have been brought up in Herzliya, that'd be the same? No, of course not. Everybody's influenced. So, right, it's something we, before we judge anybody, let's keep that in mind, right? But yes, we're all Tinoko Shanishba in a certain way. By the way, today the non-religious are offended by that when you call them Tinoko Shanishba. It's condescending. We have the right path. It's not your fault. They find that condescending. That approach doesn't work so much anymore. We have to have a different approach in dealing with non-religious Jews, whatever. They also, as Rav Lichtenstein said, they also have great values we can learn from. We have strong disagreements. Rav Lichtenstein has some amazingly positive things to say about, you know, many reform rabbis, we have much to learn from them. They're ethical people, moral. They care about a lot of things that we stop caring about. Why does reform care on so, you know, many Orthodox Jews don't care on social justice. Well, that's in the Torah. That's more in the Torah than rituals. There's more social justice in the Torah. And somehow we let, that's the reform. They can do that. That's a terrible thing. I mean, it's a wonderful thing they do it. It's a terrible thing that we're going to say, that's for the reform. What do you mean that's for the reform? You know, that's Rav Bloch's, Rav Elia Meir's Bloch's famous letter from Nitel's Yeshiva, Rosh Yeshiva tells, there are three mitzvot religious Jews don't do anywhere. He's talking to the Yeshiva boys. Don't do it. He said, Learn Tanakh, live in Israel, and speak Hebrew. Because the non-religious Jews do that one. We wrote that many years ago. Yes, but I think the professor Benny Lau had a very important point. The Chaim Leibowitz, right, we spoke about that, the Me'el Dor HaBriyot. The new Torah, Koran Tanakh states that name Shifrim Pur are Semitic. Okay, I don't know, but that's what they say. Good. Shifra is on the list of slave names in Egyptian archaeology. Cool. But an unnecessary history, very nice. This is My God by Herman Wick, right? It's another great example, right? Another example. I think Zev Elif, he just started his 10-part series on American history. I think one of his talks is on Herman Wick, sort of forgotten, but I don't know how many people have read This Is My God of a certain generation? You can raise your hand. Even if we can't see you, you can still raise your hand. We're not taking notes. But anyway, correct. I think that is another okay, thank you, everybody.
I thought it was Zeke Liva and Veyuel, okay, Aviva Roman Mehu. That's the, that right. Encapsules that idea.
What?
Doing it for me?
Zeh Livan Veyu, Elohai Aviva Aromeno. Yes, you have to do it. I don't know. If you're totally have no choice in life, you're totally brought up in a authoritarian parent and, I don't know. Okay, hold on. What's Elaine saying? When we face Hashem at the end of our lives, does he also say, it's not your fault? Yeah, he probably does. Yeah, to what degree? I mean, obviously, we don't know. Yes, I would hope God wouldn't hold us responsible. If you never learn Torah, there is a Tinok Shanishpa is a halakhic concept. That's a halakhic concept. If you were brought up in a home of idolatry and you don't know any better, that there is a halakhic concept. Just got applied today. We use it in a Balchu. We use it in a very different way. Obviously, what we don't expect God, how God judges, we don't know. That's what the Rambam wrote. We don't know what mitzvot is worth more, what mitzvot is worth less. Maybe they'll be judged in a totally different scale. Right? It's not for us to judge anybody. Maybe the Jew brought up told non-religious is going to judge how much charity does he give? How nice is he? Does he help the homeless? I don't know. But he's not going to be judged on his kashrut. He doesn't know about kashrut. Why should he keep kosher? Why should somebody who's brought up not keeping kosher keep kosher? And you know what? If they're not, it's our fault. We haven't done a good enough job explaining why kashrut is important for ethical reasons. Remember the entire Torah. Hillel says, what's the entire Torah? What's hateful to you, don't do unto others. That's the whole Torah, right? Or meaning that's why we keep Shabbos. The Rambam writes that tzedakah is the most important mitzvah asay. Remember, we did the Rambam. The entire Torah is given for peace by Hanukkah. The Rambam and Hilchot Hanukkah. The entire Torah was given for peace. That's it. The Rachei Adarchinom, everything in the Torah. It's an amazing Rambam. Amazing. So that means kashrut, mezuzah, Shabbos, mikvah, all to bring peace to the world. So if we're unable to articulate why keeping kosher makes the world a more peaceful place will be judged. We're the failures. Don't blame them. So I mean, it's you have to work on it, right? So yes, so I think we face Hashem as Rav Zushis, and we'll end here, right? Rav Zushis, was that his name? Says when he gets up to heaven, they're not going to ask him, why weren't you like, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein? Why weren't you like this? They're going to ask you, Zushia, why weren't you Zushia? They're not going to ask you why you weren't like this one. They're going to ask you, why weren't you? Why didn't you reach your potential? So that's a, don't worry, I don't know what, don't agree with my response. We're responsible for our own behavior. Yeah, it's a good question. No, we can't totally blame our parents, that's for sure. But, but parents have to blame themselves. So that's what, Rav Shimshon Val Hirsch writes. It's a little bit, your hair will stand on edge. Go read Hirsch now about Yaakov and Esav. It's Yitzchak and Rivka's fault, the way Esav turned out. Had they did not shown favoritism to their kids. Had they realized, not just favoritism, even more, had they realized they're different. They sent them to the same school. They raised them as twins. They didn't realize they are fraternal twins. And each one needed a different education. That's what he writes. And had they realized, they had they not tried to peg Esav into the Yaakov hole, had they let him play sports and go hunting as part of his fun thing, and then also what a yeshiva, whatever, you know, I know anachronistic, he could have turned out well. That's what he writes. It's Yitzchak and Rivka's fault. Wow. I mean, the Medrash says because of Yaakov having a favorite son, because of a stupid coat, we ended up in Egypt as slaves. Had Yaakov Avinu not shown favoritism to Yosef, we wouldn't have ended up in Egypt. That's what the Medrash said. So we always look to blame ourselves. But when we deal with others, no, that everybody, you know, that's only for us to do to ourselves. Okay, hope that makes sense. All right, everybody, Shabbat Shalom. The weeks are getting longer, you know, so we can, the days are getting longer, more sun. Let's hope to hear good news and peace. The whole world, the whole Torah is for peace. Let's hope that we can put peace in Israel and everywhere. And Shabbat Shalom. And was also a favor, right. Each one of the generation learned the mistakes of the parents. That's right. And Yaakov didn't learn from his parents. How could Yaakov not learn from the mistake of his parents and show favorites in Yosef? And Yosef didn't learn the lesson because he gave Binyamin five times as much he gave the brothers. Yeah, it's hard. It's very hard to learn to overcome your biases that you get as a child. Absolutely. Okay. Please invite a friend. We look forward to learning with you. Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Be well. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Yeah, Shabbos.
Thank you.
Thank you.